The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Capturing and sharing images has never been easier. From the streets of Tehran to Jerusalem, citizen and photojournalists give us a look at conflict zones the world over. But during America's Civil War, it took the work of a few intrepid photographers equipped with bulky cameras, tripods, and sheets of film to bring those images home. Among them, a Scotsman named Alexander Gardner. His work is the subject of a retrospective at the National Portrait Gallery. It's called Dark Field of the Republic. Alexander Gardner photographs 1859 to 1872. And the exhibition was curated by the Portrait Gallery's senior historian, David Ward. David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks a lot, Virginia. Really happy to be on and talking to you.
So a lot of people may not know the name Alexander Gardner, but what are some of the images that might ring a bell for us?
Well, that's actually one of the interesting things about the exhibition is that we know very little about Alexander Gardner, and he tends to be overshadowed during the Civil War by the big name, which is Matthew Brady. But we do know his pictures. We know his images of Lincoln. He was Lincoln's favorite photographer. He took multiple images of the president, well, even the president-elect in 1861 before Lincoln was inaugurated. He took major pictures of the Union generals. He was based in Washington, D.C., so there's an East Coast bias here. And then what he's really famous for and what the real impact of his work was that he took the camera out of the studio and took it to the battlefields, and he photographed the aftermath of the battles of Antietam and then Gettysburg, 1862 and then in 1863, and created these indelible, harrowing, heartbreaking images of modern industrialized warfare, which really changed first just the discipline of photography, as you said in your introduction, but it also really just changes American culture. It's the way in which America comes of age and America becomes less innocent, less romantic, more realistic, more even cynical.
It is so stunning to see these photographs, you know,
yeah,
twisted, bloated bodies on the battlefield. We would never see these now. That's one thing. They're so affecting. Do you think the Civil War photographers that went out there knew that?
Yeah, I think that this was, well, first of all, I think the thing we have to keep in mind is that Gardner and Brady or Timothy O'Sullivan, they were commercial photographers. They had to make a living. They made a living by selling their images. They weren't fine art photographers. It was a commercial transaction. You could, as an ordinary citizen, go in and buy Gardner's Lincolns or buy his book, The Dead at Antietam. And I think there was an element of photography lends itself to realism, but the camera has become becoming more and more mobile. It's more flexible. It's the cameras are becoming smaller, lighter, easier to use. And it comes out of nowhere. He's working for Matthew Brady in Washington. It's September 1862, and the Battle of Antietam, he takes his portable darkroom out to, you know, a wagon and loads it up and goes the 100-some miles out to Sharpsburg, Maryland, to the battlefield, and starts to take the pictures of the aftermath. I mean, it says something about how unprepared everyone was, that the battlefield was not cleared of debris and corpses and casualties and dead horses the 3, 4, 5 days after the battlefield. It was still just sort of smoking and festering. The New York Times said when they were displayed in Manhattan, these photographs have a terrible distinctness, that if they have not brought the war into our very houses and streets, they have done something very much like that. ever since, we have been very careful and cautious in America, in particular, about what we show in terms of casualties, the element of either de facto or official censorship. In World War II, for instance, there was no depiction of American casualties until very late in the war. And this controversy about what you can show and not show, the sensational and frankly disturbing images of dead bodies is something that we continue to debate and struggle over.
Well, you've opened up so many things, including, mm-hmm. you know, who he was politically. He was a relative newcomer to the U.S.,
right.
Emigrated from Scotland in 1856. Was he neutral? Do you have any ideas?
Well, no, actually, we know a little bit about him. We know, for instance, that he was an abolitionist. That he was on the side of the Union, and he's very sympathetic to the cause. And I think that there was also probably a political impulse, although it's very hard to tease out, that by showing the horror of war, there would be an impulse that let's not do this again.
Well, you mentioned the review from the New York Times earlier. I'm wondering how people saw these images. This is before newspapers were able to print photographs. So did people see them, and what was their reaction?
First of all, they were widely seen, and they were seen in the galleries. They photography, you could reproduce them. They were even reproduced as etchings and lithographs in the newspapers, that a photograph would be turned into something you could print up. And I think, first of all, people were stunned. People are shocked. People had a romantic view of warfare. We had a romantic view of why people fought. There was very much a kind of framework of the novels of Sir Walter Scott and the romance of chivalry, and combat was somehow clean. And then when they see the scenes where you look at, say, Bloody Lane at Antietam, where it's a shallow road in the landscape, and it's just full of corpses. I mean, it's just full of them. They're just piled up. And people were shocked. It's one of the reasons I call the exhibition Dark Fields of the Republic. I wanted to suggest the gravity and the weight and the loss of innocence that Americans experienced, that this is a period of it's a heroic period, but it's also a period of great tragedy. The other thing that occurred to me halfway through doing this exhibition, that we need to remember the sensational appeal of photography as well. And even if this is uncomfortable to us, the way in which there's a kind of fascination with looking at the dead bodies at Antietam, this is something that nobody had ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And it's appealing to the senses in a way that I think, like we slow down to look at a car crash or we turn on YouTube to look at the hanging of Saddam Hussein, there's an appeal here that we need to recognize and see it as part of, you know, human nature or a particular cultural moment, that they were sensational images, and people, however horrible they were in some ways thrilled by them.
We're talking about the Civil War photography of Alexander Gardner. His work is now the subject of a retrospective at the National Portrait Gallery, and we're speaking with the exhibition's curator and senior historian David Ward. Well, I want to talk a little bit about that sensationalism, because there is a photograph that kind of demonstrates this blurry line between artist and photojournalist in a way. One of his photographs from Gettysburg, a very well-known one, Home of a Rebel Sharpshooter.
Right. Yeah.
Now, for those unfamiliar with it, first,
right.
Describe it for us.
First, I should just back off a little bit. 1862 in the Antietam pictures allow Gardner to set up his own shop in Washington. He breaks with Brady, sets up his own photography gallery, and then, of course, the competition is really on between him and Brady. But what he does at Gettysburg, which is really unconscionable, is in trying to find scenes that were appealing and marketable, he gilds the lily. I mean, he goes too far. He takes a corpse, a Confederate casualty, out of the burial line and moves it some 75 yards into this rocky part of Devil's Den, an area on the southern part of the battlefield. And he creates this four-photograph tableau about the so-called rebel sharpshooter. So there's Home of the Rebel Sharpshooter and the Rebel Sharpshooter's Last Sleep. And he creates this little playlet of the fate in these four photographs of the dead Confederate. And the whole thing is a fiction. The poor boy who was dead is not a sharpshooter. Gardner provides the rifle, which they had picked up after the battlefield. The rifles were picked up very quickly, unlike the corpses. So at the very moment in which photography is arguing that it creates an absolutely truthful picture of photography, which is something photography still argues for, Gardner completely destroys that by manipulating it, you know, the truth, manipulating the story, creating a completely fictitious reality. It's really unconscionable, but it does raise issues that his career raises, which is at the beginning of photography, all these questions appear almost immediately, like what can you show and how far can you go in terms of manipulating the truth?
Well, Gardner was also the favored photographer of Abraham Lincoln. There's a famous photo that just weeks, I guess, before Lincoln's assassination, he looks weary. It's distinguished by the crack. There's a crack that goes along the top of it. But to me, I look at this and I think, oh my God, he was a real person, you know, less so in the portraits, but he takes pictures of Lincoln sitting there in a tent, you know, talking with someone, with other people. You know, this is someone we almost assume is in a costume. So it leads me to kind of ask the question of that kind of consciousness. Do you think that he was conscious that he was a witness to history? Was this all commercially motivated? He was just making money off of these photographs. Was he an artist, to your mind?
I think he did see himself as an artist, and he definitely knew that he was a witness to history. From the commemoration of people who may even not be known, but who were prominent at the time through the Lincoln photographs, through the photographs of the Lincoln conspirators, Booth, and when he moves west, taking pictures of the Great Plains Indians. The crack plate Lincoln, which is what you allude to, which was taken in early February 1865, is interesting because it is a complete accident. Gardner, there was no film. It was a glass plate negative, which had to be elaborately prepared. And by the way, one of the reasons why Gardner is so great, he was very skillful at the preparation of the plate and then the preparation of the solution that would allow the image in the plate to be transferred to paper. But it was a very complicated process. And at some point during that sitting, the plate cracked, probably while he was heating it, and he pulled one print of Lincoln and said, well, that's not any good, and threw the glass plate away. So the Portrait Gallery owns the only crack plate image of Lincoln, and it has this ghostly image where Lincoln is both present to us in all his worn and careworn and etched space. I mean, he's exhausted at this point at the end of the first term. But the other thing is that we know that he's going to die. We know, looking backwards, that he has about 6 weeks to live. And so this is the collision between February 1865, where Lincoln has all these plans of ending the war, freedom and the vote for black men, ending slavery, the whole thing, the package. And none of it's going to happen. And there's this, us looking back, there's this sense of inevitability in which Lincoln is now transferred from being an historical subject of an actual human being into a mythological figure.
David Ward, do you have a favorite Gardner image?
Actually, I do. I mean, the crack plate is a great image, but the image I like of Lincoln, it's the November 8th, 1863 image of Lincoln that was taken just before the Gettysburg Address, and it's a full-face view of Lincoln, which was a little bit unusual. Gardner usually posed Lincoln slightly in profile or at a slant, and it's right before the Gettysburg Address, and I am convinced that Lincoln had that picture taken in Gardner's studio on 7th Street, just around the corner from the Portrait Gallery today. And he saw the pictures of that Gardner had taken of Gettysburg and the casualties in the studio while he was sitting and, you know, and they were fussing around taking the pictures. And I think that looking at those photographs from Gettysburg influenced the way that Lincoln constructed the Gettysburg Address. That he didn't visit the actual battlefield in July, of course, but he saw secondhand Gardner's images of the corpses and the destruction and the blasted equipment and horses and the landscape all torn up. And that's where Lincoln begins to think about the great phrase at the Gettysburg Address that nothing we do or say here can consecrate this ground any more than those who have died here have already consecrated it. And so it's for us, the living, and to dedicate ourselves to a new birth of freedom. In other words, this sacrifice that's portrayed by Gardner leads to the notion that the war had to be fought for higher stakes, that it had to be fought for freedom, not just for the Union. And so that portrait, which is a tremendously dramatic image of Lincoln, connects with the battlefield pictures and connects with the whole history of the war, and I think it's unbelievable.
Well, David Ward, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Hope your listeners do, too.
Me, too. David Ward is the senior historian at the National Portrait Gallery, which is showing Dark Fields of the Republic, Alexander Gardner photographs from 1859 to 1872. You can get a little preview by looking at some of the photographs online. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It seems that for every special occasion, there's a special dessert. There's cake on birthdays and for weddings, an assortment of pies on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and cookies at a funeral. Meg Favreau is a writer and comedian. She explored the history and meaning behind funeral dessert traditions in an article for the food magazine Table Matters. When and where did you discover the lost tradition of the funeral cookie?
Well, last year I went to this great event here in Los Angeles called the Death Salon. It's put on by this group called the Order of the Good Death, which is a small collection of generally young funeral professionals, scholars who are interested in death, and journalists who are interested in death. And so it was just a really fascinating group of people. And for the last evening party, there's this fantastic writer and cook, Sarah Elizabeth Troop, who runs a blog called Nourishing Death, and she created this amazing spread of funeral foods for the evening. And the thing that really caught my eye were there were these little 2-inch square paper packages that had wax seals on them. And when you open them up, inside was a small buttery spiced cookie. And that was a funeral biscuit.
What is the origin of this funeral biscuit?
Well, it has a really long history, but this particular one, the wrapped funeral biscuit, goes back to about Victorian England, where they would be given away as a memento at the end of funerals. And there's actually a great example of one that not only was a wrapped funeral biscuit, but it has the deceased's name on it and a poem to remember them by.
Wow. Well, how have funeral dessert traditions varied across cultures?
The types of foods vary widely. There's different types of cookies. In Wales, it's more of a lady finger. In colonial America, it was more of like a buttery biscuit, usually molasses-based. But it always has to do with basically breaking bread together and sharing memories of the deceased.
You write about another funeral food trend that died out some time ago. Now, this is called sin eating. What is that?
Oh, sin eating is fascinating. It's the process of passing food or drink over a corpse to a person who then eats it. And the person who eats it takes on the sins of the deceased so they can go on into heaven sin free. Sometimes it would be the relatives who did this at a funeral. But in some communities, there were actually poor people in the community who were paid a small amount to eat sins.
Wow.
And they were generally looked down on. Yeah. There's actually a community in Shropshire that claims to have the grave of the last sin eater who died in 1906.
That's quite a sacrifice to make.
Yeah.
I can see that you wouldn't have a lot of takers for that one. But why do you think these funeral dessert traditions fell out of fashion?
I don't think they necessarily fell out of fashion. I think that they've changed. You know, we might not take away cookies from funerals anymore, but we often have other little bits of memory to take away, whether it's a bracelet with the deceased's name, or even just a program where people have contributed memories that they have about the deceased. And we still share food after funerals. You know, when my grandmother died, one of the most powerful parts of the day of the funeral was going to my grandmother's house after and sharing in all of the food that everyone brought to celebrate my grandmother and remember her.
The kind of casseroles and left in the freezer, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Were you, Meg, able to find any of the original recipes from some of these more traditional funeral desserts, like the funeral biscuit, for example?
Well, the thing that's interesting about recipes like this is that because they were so common, they were things that everybody made, they weren't put in cookbooks. And so it's actually hard to find many of the original recipes for these. So the recipes that I have with my article are based on a lot of research. For example, the Welsh funeral cookies are ladyfinger-like. So I have a ladyfinger recipe from the time period. And the American colonial funeral cookies were buttery, molasses, and often seasoned with caraway seeds. And so I developed a recipe based off my research for that.
Hmm. So what would you do if you were going to update the funeral cookie for the 21st century? Of course, you're in Los Angeles. Would it be made out of spelt or something like that?
I think that the updated funeral cookie is really just a classic cookie that you love. It's something that you can give to everyone and share and people find comforting. So, I mean, personally, I always think a nice piece of shortbread is comforting and good to share. And the recipe that I developed for the molasses cookie, it's molassesy, it's buttery. I mean, that's really, I hate to utter the phrase my ideal funeral cookie because that sounds a little bizarre, but I think that's actually my ideal funeral cookie.
Meg Favreau, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Meg Favreau, she's a writer and comedian, and you'll find a link to her article for Table Matters called A Snack Called Death and her recipe for funeral biscuits. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Despite the proliferation of online sources for recipes, cookbooks are still selling briskly. They're inspiring and often beautiful, but are they worth studying? Well, maybe when you have a massive collection spanning hundreds of years. That is a treasure trove for scholars looking at American foodways and domesticity. This summer, Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, acquired a collection of more than 700 historical cookbooks, at least one of which was written before the Declaration of Independence was signed. Marika von der Steenhoven is Outreach Fellow for Special Collections at Bowdoin and has been digging in through the collection for the past few months. Marika, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much, Virginia. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me a little bit more about the scope of these cookbooks. What's the earliest and what's the most recent?
Absolutely. So the Esta Kramer Collection of American Cookery spans over 724 cookery books. The earliest imprint we have is from 1772, and that's originally a British book, but was published in Boston in 1772. That book actually features engravings from Paul Revere. So that's where we start, and we end up in the 1960s with the year that the Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking was published. So the bulk of the collection is really from the colonial era through the 1900s.
So how about the oddest cookbook in the collection that you've discovered?
Oh. There is a wide variety of different types of books represented. It's kind of every type of cookbook you could imagine, from cookbooks for every social and economic level, regional cuisines, quantity cooking, single subject cooking, cooking with a few ingredients, cooking with leftovers, economic cooking, and cookery books for appliance and gadgets. What's coming to mind is a book that I find physically beautiful as well as quite fascinating, and that is The Bachelor and the Chafing Dish. So that's a cookbook that is directed specifically to the male bachelor, and the chafing dish was actually used for one room or apartment living, and it was gentlemen would cook meals just in a chafing dish, and that's what that book is geared towards. And it's not the only chafing dish cookbook in the collection, which I find particularly interesting.
I suppose you must also see some pretty unusual recipes. Any spring to mind?
Oh, absolutely. So there's something called syllabub, which is a sweet dish or drink of British origin, and I have here a recipe that says to make a fine syllabub from the cow. So you take a sweetened quart of hard cider and sugar and nutmeg, and then you actually milk your cow directly into the liquor, and that kind of fermentation and the reaction between the liquor and the milk is a sweet dessert drink. There's also examples like a calf's head pie. You almost boil a calf's head and then you make a pie out of it. The other thing that I find quite entertaining, and various of the readers who've come in and used the collection thus far have noted that a lot of these early cookbooks call for boiling vegetables for hours on end, which is something that we would never do, or at least I would never do today.
Now, you called it the Esther Kramer Collection. How did Bowdoin end up with this collection?
Yeah, so Esther Kramer is a good friend of the college and generously donated the funds for us to acquire it from a rare book dealer located in Maine named Rabelais. The collection itself was actually amassed by a retired banker named Cliff Apgard. He and his wife spent several decades collecting all American cookbooks. And so when it came time for him to move on and start collecting something else, he worked with the rare book dealer, and then the rare book dealer Bowdoin and Esther worked together to get it into Bowdoin's possession.
So, Marika, what is the value of this kind of collection for researchers? What mm-hmm. might they be looking at and why?
Absolutely. I mean, I think beyond just the cooking, the collection really illuminates the development of American culture, and it encompasses American social movements as well, and major historical events. So, for example, there are cookbooks that document women's suffrage, the temperance movement, the African-American experience. For example, there is a book by Robert Roberts called The House Servants' Directory, and that is actually the very first sort of domestic book or cookery book written by an African-American, but it's also one of the first books written by an African-American to be issued by a commercial press. We see documentation of the Civil War, the Industrial Revolution, technological applications in the household, immigration, westward expansion. So there's all sorts of historical perspectives that we can get. One of the things that we've been using the collection for are classroom visits. So Bowdoin is a small liberal arts college, and we have classes that come into Special Collections. And I've worked with several classes thus far, one class called In Sickness and in Health. That class is looking at historical perspectives of medicine and public health, and they've been using the medicinal recipes that appear in most of these cookbooks as a way to sort of track different trends in terms of healing throughout American history.
Well, that's kind of fascinating, especially because so many conversations about food these days revolve around health.
Exactly. The class that came in specifically was looking at the different uses of alcohol and the moral tones of alcohol and the way that that was used. Looking at specific examples from this collection taken from different eras, you begin to see the way that science starts to infiltrate both cooking as well as the medicinal and the health properties found in cooking and remedies, as opposed to home remedies. For example, there's one cookbook that I was looking at recently where the advice was for a woman who had had a big pain in her hand was swollen, and it was a home remedy that said, well, you know, you should try sticking your finger in a cat's ear because we've heard examples of transferring the pain from the hand to the cat, and it took more than two men to carry that cat away because it actually, all of the woman's pain transferred to the cat, which it sounds like hocus pocus to us now, but
yes.
It's interesting to sort of see how home remedies evolve into a maybe more scientific approach that that we see today.
Well, you mentioned science. How about technology? And earlier you said something about new appliances, you know,
right.
new range or something like that. Other than the chafing dish, do you get a sense
right.
of how technology has changed cooking?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you get a sense, well, in 1772, we weren't using electric ranges in our homes or natural gas stoves, right? So you see how cooking has changed from using a hearth to using a wood stove to using a gas range or an electric range that we're familiar with today. The other thing to think about is refrigeration. In one of the early cookbooks from the 19th century, there is a recipe for how to keep your peas until Christmas. So thinking about without refrigeration, what are the modes that we're using to save food throughout the winter?
Thinking about how rare it must be. Even households without books probably had a family Bible and probably a cookbook.
Exactly. And that's an interesting thing because there are a lot of product cookbooks as well. So when I say a product cookbook, it's something that's put out by a flour company, for example, or baking powder. And there's that type that actually uses that ingredient in each of the recipes. But then there were other types of product cookbooks that were just a way to actually keep advertising in the home. Because it's a cookbook, because it's going to be kept, it's a way to keep advertisement kind of in the household. So they're not just going to discard that like they would a flyer, but the cookbook will remain a part of the home.
And this is one body of literature that was pretty much consistently aimed at women.
Yes, absolutely. You get a wonderful sense of both women being authors, but also women being written to specifically about how to build a home, advice for young women who perhaps are without their family. If you think about westward expansion, you think about women leaving their families. And so that knowledge that's generally passed down from generation to generation is now being transmitted in a domestic advice or a cookery book. So it's a wonderful way to kind of track and study women as well as gender in this wonderful primary source.
Is this collection open to the public?
This collection is absolutely open to the public. In special collections here at Bowdoin, we primarily serve the students and faculty and staff, but our collections are open to researchers. We're open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and we welcome visitors of all walks of life to come and engage with our collections.
Well, so interesting. Marika, thank you for speaking with us.
Virginia, thank you so much. This was such a pleasure.
Marika von der Steenhoven, Outreach Fellow for the George J. Mitchell Department of Special Collection at Bowdoin College's Library. That's in Brunswick, Maine. You can find out more about the collection of more than 700 historical cookbooks and actually see some photographs from the collection. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to American holidays, Christmas and Thanksgiving are the favorites. That's at least according to a Harris Interactive poll. For comedian Dana Gould, it's all about Halloween. Throughout his career in comedy, Dana Gould has performed on The Late Show with David Letterman, on Conan, The Ben Stiller Show, as well as in his own stand-up specials for HBO. But his love of Halloween and the B-horror movies that come with it is perhaps most evident in the 7 years he spent writing and producing The Simpsons. Among the episodes he worked on, Treehouse of Horror 17, for which he is credited as co-executive producer Dana Gould. You know, with an H, get it? Dana Gould is the host of the podcast, The Dana Gould Hour. So pleased to welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, and ready to be creeped out if you don't mind.
Indeed. Let's lay down our Halloween rules right out of the gate.
Okay.
I need you to wear something reflective, go with a friend, and don't go into anyone's house if you don't know them.
And don't accept handmade goods or apples.
Yeah. Don't accept any apple with a razor blade handle sticking out of it.
Well, in addition to your rules, you've come prepared to it with a long list of must-see Halloween B-movies. Which has gotten the most play, do you think, in the Gould household?
Well, I like to reference movies that you... I mean, we all know the big movie, Night of the Living Dead, you know, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman,
right,
which is a particular favorite of mine because of the title. I like that it's not Frankenstein versus the Wolfman.
Oh, they just
meet. They had this attitude, let's have them meet and see what happens. Let's just let them meet. But there are some movies that are great that you may not know about. Probably number one on the list with a bullet, Carnival of Souls from 1962, made by a guy named Herc Harvey, who basically made industrial films. And it sort of anticipated Night of the Living Dead before Night of the Living Dead. It's quite a brilliant little movie, very, very creepy, about a young woman who escapes death in a car accident, or did she?
Anybody we'd recognize in the movie, or is it...
Nobody. It stars screen legend Candace Hillegas.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and Herc Harvey himself. But you'll see the story if you know, the film's final destination that were big past decade or so. They're all, each one is in and of itself a remake of Carnival of Souls. It's about somebody who escapes death and death not letting go so easily. It's really a brilliant little movie. For a fun, great B-movie, I recommend The Alligator People.
Oh, I know that one.
The Alligator People is fantastic. It's a black and white film, beautifully shot, really looks like what you think about in terms of a late 50s, late 60s B-horror film. It stars Lon Chaney Jr., and in the film, he has one of my favorite lines in all of history. There's, you know, classic lines, play it again, Sam, here's looking at you, kid.
Mm-hmm.
The Alligator People adds to that lexicon with, I will always hate gators.
Dirty, stinking, slimy gators. You bit my hand off, didn't you? I'm going to spend the rest of my life killing gators. The rest of my life. Cheer.
So you're talking about movies from the 60s, but some of the films on your list go back to the late 40s, 50s, long before your time.
Yeah, the house on... Oh, yeah, long before my time. I was... I grew up in Massachusetts, dutifully watching Creature Double Feature on TV 56. Channel 56 with Dale Dorman. And so, yeah, my film education actually predates my existence. A great B-movie from that era, late 50s, The House on Haunted Hill, made by the great William Castle, who is sort of the working class version of Alfred Hitchcock. Vincent Price in fine form, and shot at the Frank Lloyd Wright House in Los Feliz, California.
Well, let's hear just a little bit from that film.
I'm Frederick Lauren, and I've rented the house on Haunted Hill tonight so that my wife can give a party, a haunted house party. She's so amusing. There'll be food and drink and ghosts, and perhaps even a few murders. You're all invited.
Of course, that's Vincent Price. Like, basically, he pays people $10,000 if they can last a whole night on Haunted Hill.
Now, when the house is on Haunted Hill, you pretty much assume you know what's going on. I've rented the house on Haunted Hill to throw a Tupperware party to keep your food fresh over long periods.
Now, that is
it's
creepy.
It's on Haunted Hill, for God's sakes. And you get a, yeah, that's a beautiful, and the real star of that movie, aside from Vincent Price, who gives an amazing Vincent Price caliber performance, is the actual house itself, which is, as I said, a Frank Lloyd Wright house, which is also in the end of the film Blade Runner. It's the same building.
You wouldn't think that a Frank Lloyd Wright house would be the haunted house. You'd think of the, you know, Victorian with the mansard roof.
Yeah, that was the brilliance of William Castle. He did he flipped it. And it works great. It's and that house is still there, which is weird because in the city of Los Angeles, there are now 4 buildings over 20 years old.
And that's
one of
them.
Four, and we're very proud. You know, I have children, so you have to be careful about what movies you throw on for Halloween. Surprisingly, a huge hit with my kids, and my kids are savvy modern kids with no attention spans. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein from 1948.
Okay,
we love it.
We've got a clip from that. Let's hear it.
Where is it?
I saw a hand there.
You don't know what you're talking about. You're all excited reading this legend. Now listen. Listen, Wilbur. I know there's no such a person as Dracula. You know there's no such a person as Dracula.
But does Dracula know it?
Now listen to me. McDougal will be here any minute with the insurance agent. Now get to work.
Beautiful. Now, what's interesting about that film, two things. Bela Lugosi, who, you know, people associate with the role of Dracula, plays Dracula in the movie, was not Universal Studios' first choice to play him. I think the director had to say, what about Bela Lugosi? And they were going, yeah, I don't know.
But this was actually the first of many that they started introducing Abbott and Costello to.
They ended up meeting everybody.
Count Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman.
Yeah, they met Frankenstein, they met Wolf. Yeah, then they met Abbott and Costello meet the Mummy, Abbott and Costello meet the Invisible Man, they met Fluoridation. They met all the threats of the day.
So that's a kind of family-friendly horror comedy. Any truly terrifying B-movie horror films, you know, where you... That transparent line just comes down.
Oh, sure. Oddly, the 1970s was a great decade for really scary films. One film from that decade that does not get its credit is a film called Let's Scare Jessica to Death. Early 70s movie, low budget, incredibly creepy, hampered only by... It must have been from like 71 or 72 when people really... needed cream rinse and haircuts. It is only hampered by that. There are some mustaches in that movie that would not make it onto the screen today, but highly recommended. And then two TV movies that I recall from the early 70s that were really scary. One of them, When Michael Calls, which
oh, right.
I believe
okay.
is from 1972.
All right, we have a little clip of that. Let's hear it.
Hello? Hello?
Andy, my Helen.
Yes, hello?
Andy, my Helen, I missed the school bus. Come and get me.
Who is this?
It's Michael.
What? Hello? Hello?
Elizabeth Ashley playing the aunt of a boy who died, what, 14 years earlier or something like
yes.
that?
Yes.
When you grew up, there were movies like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween, The Omen, you know, The Exorcist out in
right.
theaters. Those were sort of the more realistic ones. You didn't think that the B movies that you were watching were hokey?
I did, but I love them for the hokiness. I love the fact that they tried. You know, Plan 9 from Outer Space is one of my favorite movies of all time, because I feel like if I got to make a movie, it'd probably come out like that.
We're talking to the comedian and host of the Dana Gould Hour podcast, Dana Gould, about the wicked scariest movies he grew up watching. Well, how important is it to know the backstory of the movies to you? You mentioned directors and you mentioned switches. And
none
actors.
At all. I enjoy it because it's my football. You know, it's my I don't have a fantasy football team, but I can tell you who directed The Night Stalker. It's just my area of interest. It's what I grew up loving. But you don't need to. But I kind of love the fact that, like in Plan 9 from Outer Space, you can see that the graveyard is a set. You can see the when somebody falls down, you can see the cardboard graves sort of shaking. I don't know why, but it appeals to me. We have an expression in show business called hair in the gate, which is when you'd have to check after you shot a scene, you have to check the camera to make sure that there wasn't a hair in the lens, because mm-hmm. that would show up in the film. Sometimes I like it when there's a hair in the gate. It gives it a little sense of flaw.
And you've taken this love of these horror movies into the real world, befriending, is it Myla Nurmi? Is that how you pronounce her name?
Yes. Myla Nurmi was in the film Plan 9 from Outer Space. She was the very first person to host horror movies. Her alter ego was Vampyra. She first premiered in Los Angeles on local television in 1954 and created this character, sort of a sexier version of Morticia Adams. And before Morticia Adams was on television, by the way, by 6 or 7 years. And she was really, she started that whole sort of genre of entertainment that later begat Goulardi and Zachary and Creature Double Feature. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed her in 1995 for a little documentary I was making on horror movie hosts, because I'm so obsessed with them. And we became good friends, and we stayed very close friends for the rest of her life.
Yeah, she died, what, 2008?
She passed on in 2008, but that didn't stop me from putting her on my new podcast.
That's a really good Halloween trick, raising the dead for an interview.
Tis. I dug up an old interview. Get it?
So why is it important to keep the legacy alive of these people who were, you know, not even the actors in some cases, but the hosts, the presenters of Creature Double Features and scary movies?
The lower down the show business ladder you get, the more comfortable I feel. You know, in the evolutionary map of show business, where movie stars and opera divas are at the far end, I'm much more comfortable way down here helping the rodeo clown get into the barrel.
You're sort of this little fish crawling out of the water part of evolution.
That's my comfort zone. I would much rather go to a carnival than the symphony. And it's just the stuff I love.
Well, thanks for putting a little hair on our lens or microphone or whatever metaphor I can mix up for this one.
Yeah, hair in the windscreen.
Really appreciate your time.
Oh my God, I had such a great time. Thank you so very much.
Dana Gould, actor, producer, comedian, and host of the podcast The Dana Gould Hour. We've compiled a list of his must-see B-horror movies on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, remember, you can catch it on the Word of Mouth podcast in its entirety. Just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you enjoy it, please write a review. It'll help others find us. And as we know, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.